This is Nightline, bringing the world to your front door, and this is Walter O'Keefe. May I come in, too? Thank you, and I'm happy to hear your answer was okay, because I'm bringing some mighty interesting people along with me. Hans Conried, the Nightline detective, with a brand new item, the 5-Minute Midget Mystery. Also a world-famous mystery writer with some fantastic true cases of how science solves murder cases, Earl Stanley Gardner. President Eisenhower's press conference this morning, the sounding board from New Orleans, and in just a few moments, some very pleasant moments with Mike Nichols and Elaine May. But first, with detailed instructions on how to get there, the four lads.
And get your hat, leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Hear the pitter-pitter-pat, and that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street.
I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade, but I'm not afraid. This rover crossed over.
If I never have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street.
Four lads, hot but happy with a treat from the sunny side of the street. This is Nightline, happy to interrupt whatever is happening to bring you hot news from anywhere in this wide, wide world. With a hot new comedy team, we'll be right back in 60. Moments in every life when great new combinations are discovered. The day you discovered the guy you knew would make a great mister to your missus. Or maybe the day you discovered that delightful combination known as sardine, tomato, and onion on a roll. But I can't imagine a happier new combination ever coming along than will. Here they come along right now. This is prior to their going to the coast for their opening at the Macambo on Sunset Strip. Mike Nichols and Elaine May sitting on the front porch rockers, and my, how they have aged.
Hello, Emma.
Hello, Max. How are you?
A little tired. Walk seems longer every day.
Yeah, you know, you're 2 minutes and 40 seconds late, you know. Do you mean you haven't been late now in, let's see, I remember 14 years ago when it was raining that time.
It wasn't raining. I remember because that was the day that Marcia had all her teeth out. You remember?
Oh, yes, I remember that.
She came over, you know, she was nursing the dog over at the Perkins.
But do you remember how you came in? And you were a minute and 17 seconds
18.
Late.
No, it was 18. I was, remember, because I stopped by. Marcia had all her teeth out.
Now, wait a minute, because I remember, because that was the day that Louie dropped the cream soda on his way from the grocery store.
That was not the same day. Louie dropped the cream soda. Louie dropped the cream soda the same week that Mark got stung on that stupid horse.
No, remember Mark the bad got horse Mark stung bought? On the horse. When Edith's pump broke, because I remember she had been dirty for 2 weeks and wouldn't go to the hospital to see him because she was embarrassed.
True. Yes, I remember Edith was very dirty.
Would you like some Schweppes?
Yeah, I'll have some Schweppes, sure.
Ice?
Well, I don't know.
I'm
having a little trouble. Yes, Gabe, give me the Schweppes.
Got a little surprise for you this time.
Yeah, what's that?
Soda crackers instead of graham crackers.
Emma, I don't show. You really are one. Soda crackers
just
instead
bought
of
him,
graham
that's
crackers.
What I did.
You just went out and got...
Yes, sir. Max?
Yeah?
I had a question I wanted to ask you.
Sure, Emma. What you got to say?
I've been, you've been following the you've been following Ann Landers?
Yes, you read her every day.
Well, you know, I read a very interesting thing, and that is that after a certain amount of time, the sparkle goes out of things. And I was going to say, Max, you've been coming around here guzzling up my ginger ale for about 25 years now.
Yeah.
And, I'm getting tired of waiting. And I figured I know first you had your mother and then the dog was sick all that time and then
The dog is still not well. It's not a healthy dog.
It's going to die soon, Max, and then what you going to do for company?
I guess I'll get another dog.
Will you or won't you marry me? Will you or won't you?
What do you mean?
I'm just asking you straight out.
Will I or won't I?
Do you want to marry me or don't you? Because there's other fish in the sea.
I don't. I never. In all these.
You don't want to marry me?
25.
Just a minute.
Emma, in 25 years, I never gave you any reason to believe. I had my dog.
You don't want to marry me?
Fine.
That's very good. All right. Can I please have my ginger ale back? Put down the soda cracker.
All right, you don't. All right.
You don't want to marry me?
Good.
You don't have to.
No, I won't drink your ginger ale. Fine.
That's
fine.
Very good.
All right.
And I hope you're very happy with your dog.
I'll just go home with my dog. All right. 12.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's all right with me.
That's very good. Fine with me. Good. Go.
I'm going.
Well,
I'm going now. You're not going to see me.
No. All right. Go. Go ahead. Good. I don't care.
All right. Never again. All right.
Fine. Good. Fine. 25 years of ginger ale. Gone down the drain.
Mike Nichols and Elaine May, growing old but not exactly gracefully. Can't you imagine a wedding like that? The four of them would be so happy. Mike and Elaine and the two people that they'd get to carry them over the threshold. Anyway, this is Nightline passing into another quarter hour. We'll be right back in 60.
Thank you.
In Washington today, President Eisenhower's office released a special document, a scientific document, which was called one of the most important of the century. For a report on it, we turn now to NBC's Robert McCormick in Washington.
An Earth satellite simply cannot drop a bomb. An object released from a satellite does not fall. So in order to bomb from a satellite, we would have to install a launching device in the satellite, at least as complicated as the device needed to launch an intercontinental missile right here on Earth. So why use a satellite? But satellites will become routine parts of our lives, giving us more accurate weather reports, expanding worldwide communications, including intercontinental television. Satellites and rockets will let us see, for the first time, the backside of the moon and the surfaces of Mars and Venus, and many other things that the human never expected to see, all the sights in space that are illuminated in ultraviolet and radio waves. These incredible statements came today from one of the most fascinating documents I've read in the 20 very odd years I've been in the reporting business. The document was prepared by the President's Science Advisory Committee, headed by Dr. James Killian. Mr. Eisenhower asked that the statement be drawn up as an understandable but not childish outline of what outer space really is and why we are straining ourselves so mightily to explore it. I have found this statement so informative and interesting, said the President, that I wish to share it with all the people of America and indeed with all the people of the Earth. There are four reasons we find space exploration irresistible, the paper says. First, curiosity. Second, defense considerations. Third, national prestige. And fourth, the almost unlimited scientific information we'll be able to get. If there were no atmosphere, the paper says, a 10-ton satellite and a feather launched as satellites would move together at the same speed and in the same paths. Actually, we haven't yet gone out to the point where space is a true vacuum, so the feather would really slow down and fall sooner. The paper says it would probably cost a couple of $1 billion to send a man to the moon and bring him back, but that getting information from the moon and Mars and Venus and intervening areas will be much cheaper and can be done much sooner. So far as the moon is concerned, it is scientifically important that we learn how much natural radioactivity there is on the moon, so we should be careful not to contaminate it before we can get an honest check. This could be taken as an argument against the idea of exploding a hydrogen bomb on the moon just to see what would happen. Perhaps topping everything, the paper says, will be the data we will get about our own little Earth. Robert McCormick, NBC News, Washington.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much. This is Nightline, continuing in a few moments with the King of Mysteries, Earl Stanley Gardner. But first, hear this.
Greta Martin stared through the shimmering candlelight at the man she had loved, and her feeling of contempt for him now was reflected in her eyes. You'd better leave town while you can, she said, because first thing in the morning I'm going to turn state's evidence. This is Ed Herlihy, your host on My True Story. Tomorrow you'll hear the drama of a woman who was torn by a conflict between love and duty. She couldn't go on loving a man who had wantonly betrayed the people who had trusted him. But could she go on living without him? You'll hope that Greta can find a way to live with her conscience without losing her one chance for happiness as you listen tomorrow to My True Story. My True Story, America's number one morning radio program, is heard every weekday on NBC. So enjoy My True Story and My True Story's new companion program, Don Ameche's Real Life Stories, for an absorbing hour of dramatic listening every weekday morning over most of these same NBC stations.
Here's something that's as Spanish as a Spanish omelet. Ron Goodwin's orchestra waving the red cloak. Red Cloak, which in our own somewhat roundabout way brings us to a man who has been writing cloak and dagger type stories and delighting readers for many a full moon. His name is Earl Stanley Gardner, and he has undoubtedly put more people on the edge of more seats than a manufacturer of modern chairs. His victims are never killed by butlers, maybe because there aren't too many people left but us Rockefellers and Vanderbilts and O'Keefes with butlers nowadays. Earl Stanley Gardner is on our open line right now, and pretty close to the California-Mexico line, too, we understand. Mr. Gardner, there seems to be a bit of a mystery about exactly where you do live. I understand you live near Temecula, which is near San Diego. How far from Temecula are you?
Well, about 4 miles, I guess. That depends on how you define Temecula. Temecula was just a wide place in the road down here, and then they moved the road, so have a hard time finding it.
Well, Perry Mason would find it. I have no doubt about that. Now, Mr. Gardner, in all your fascinating years in the field of crime solution, what is the story or the case, perhaps, that has most fascinated you?
You mean in real life?
Yeah.
Well, heck, Walter, that's kind of... Well, now, wait a minute. I'll tell you one that interests me, always has interested me. It's the question of the application of science to the solution of murders. I don't think we realize the extent to which science has played a part. Now, my friend, Dr. Lemoyne Snyder, who is the author of Homicide Investigation, a textbook for officers, in fact, a Bible for officers on homicide. He's not only an attorney at law, but he's a doctor of medicine. Had a case that he's told me about that always fascinated me. It was up in one of the northern states on a winter night, and the telephone operator had the light come on. She plugged into the line and heard a woman screaming. Then after a while, a man reported fire. And the fire department finally got out there through the deep snow. They found this man running around in the snow, screaming in agony, and his wife dead. She had apparently been burned to death while she was trying to put some kerosene on the fire, and it had exploded. And her death was considered accidental, and she was embalmed and buried. Some 6 weeks later, Dr. Snyder was called into the case. Some things began to interest him. The body was exhumed. Dr. Snyder and one other doctor, I've forgotten his name now, but he became very famous afterwards, went into court, and I remember Dr. Snyder telling about his testimony. He got on the stand, and he testified that the woman had first been given liquor. Then she had been hit over the head with a waffle iron. Then she had been choked with chloroform. Then she had been burnt. And that the things happened in that order, that the death was not accidental but was a homicide. The attorney for the defendant was preparing to cross-examine him when the defendant completely collapsed and confessed, and it turned out that he had actually done those things in exactly that same sequence. There isn't time to tell you the scientific means by which they find these things out, but there are so many fascinating things that they can. For instance, you take a person in a fire, for instance, and if that person is inhaling in a burning building, the carbon monoxide gets in the blood. But if the person is not inhaling, why, the carbon monoxide naturally doesn't get into the blood. And there are a lot of other things that, for instance, we don't realize it, but even a skinny man has a lot of microscopic fat cells beneath his skin, subcutaneous fat. And if a person has struck a blow, many of those little fat cells break up and get into the bloodstream and go through the bloodstream until they come to the small capillaries in the lungs. And when they get to these capillaries in the lungs, this fatty emboli collects. And the trained pathologist, the criminal pathologist who knows what to look for, can go into the lungs and can tell if a man has been engaged in a fight or has been struck blows prior to the time of death. And that happens even after the body is burnt. My friend Dr. Snyder I've been out on a few cases with him, and I'm always fascinated in watching him work. He's a veritable Sherlock Holmes, only a modern Sherlock Holmes.
Well, Lemoyne Snyder and Ray Schindler and Nard Keeler, the lie detector fellow, were in my house in Pasadena one night. They have it all. Mr. Gardner, and all the thousands of stories that have flowed from that inexhaustible fountain of your typewriter, did you ever pull a boner?
Well, I've come awfully close to pulling one, but I know that there was one case under a pen name where I changed the first draft and second draft of the story, and part of the first draft remained over in there so that I had one of the beneficiaries of a will signing as a witness, and we didn't catch that until after it got into print. But ordinarily, we just sweat things out. I have a staff of very competent secretaries, and I have a very complete library on forensic medicine and toxicology and all that, and of course, I study it all the time, and we try to check things, but every once in a while, something gets past us.
Well, an error may occasionally get past you, but I know this. Darn few mystery writers ever have or will. Earl Stanley Gardner, many thanks for opening your door to our open line. It's been most interesting.
It was a pleasure, Walter. Gosh, I sure enjoyed it.
I hope you'll enjoy our new Nightline mystery. Coming up in the next half hour, as much as mystery fans, we're sure enjoyed listening to you. This is Nightline. We'll be back soon.
Bob Hope, James Stewart, and Rosalind Russell introduce Hollywood's greatest stars on the Academy Awards show tonight on most of these NBC stations.
You're on the right line. This is Nightline, and I'm Walter O'Keefe. Right now, it's a direct line to Morgan Beatty and his Minority Report.
Walter, the Minority Report tonight is really Minority. The subject, the Presidential News Conference on the anniversary week of the 45th year of this particular function of our free press and radio. The first point I want to make is that no president of the United States has ever been obligated to hold a news conference, past, present, or future. There is nothing in our tradition or our laws to make it so. The fact is, however, that any president has a need for extra official communication with the people. State papers and occasional appearances in public are not enough. There's another need behind the need. It's for the press and radio reporters to reflect faithfully the thoughts of the chief executive along the byways of his truly remarkable and awesome legal power as the head of the nation. Thus, we have a tremendous responsibility in the presidential press conference. Walter, when our republic was founded, and for a long time afterward, presidents and their supporters actually bought newspaper plants and editors, if you please, to sling mud and worse at each other. The names used to designate Andrew Jackson and his own nicknames for his enemies are not fit to print today. And you may remember that hostile editors in Lincoln's time called him a baboon in print and undertook to tell him how to run the White House and the Civil War because he didn't have the brains, they said, to do it. In more nearly modern times, President Theodore Roosevelt had a habit of confiding little tidbits of information to friendly reporters. Thus, he launched trial balloons in political ideas. And if a given Teddy Roosevelt idea proved unpopular, he immediately called the reporter who wrote the story a liar. They formed a club with other prominent citizens, called it the Ananias Club, after Ananias, the biblical character in Acts chapter 5. He sold a piece of land and lied about the price. Various presidents have tried various ways to meet the press. As we have heard, Wilson was the first to make it a face-to-face meeting with the reporters. In later years, Franklin D. Roosevelt made it catch-as-catch-can, Q&A. He openly used the press conference to get his ideas on page one to beat the hostile editors to the punch on their editorial pages. Harry Truman has said privately, "Give me page one and I don't care what happens on the editorial page." The press conference thus has become an instrument of the chief executive to be used as he sees fit, regardless of party or anything else. And, Walter, this I approve, even though I know many people will disagree. On balance, this can be said. No other nation has ever had such intimate contact with its leaders as the United States. And in recent years, both the presidents and the reporters have conducted themselves on a plane that will go down in history as a great contribution to the right of people to know what happens in their government. Minority Report, Morgan Beatty, NBC News.
Morgan Beatty and his Minority Report, a report which often deals with the American freedoms, and which reminds me of the story Archibald Rutledge used to tell about a young mockingbird he captured so that he would hear its beautiful song whenever he wanted to. On the second day of its captivity, its mother flew to the cage with food in her bill and the following day, the tiny caged bird died. A leading ornithologist explained that a mother mockingbird finding its young in a cage will sometimes bring it poison berries. She feels it better for one she loves to die rather than live in captivity.
Use clean toothpaste, clean for people who can't brush their teeth after every meal.
Happy birthday today to Robert Frost, 83 years old today, a great American poet, winner of not only 3 Pulitzer Prizes, but also the hearts of tens of thousands of people who ordinarily turn the page when they find a poem on it. So happy birthday, Robert Frost. And now we of Nightline turn the page to some Tin Pan Alley type of poetry set to music and very prettily rendered by Doris Day.
Every little breeze is sighing of love undying at sundown. Every little bird is resting, feather nesting at sundown. Each little rosebud is sleeping, while shadows are creeping. In a little cottage cozy, the world seems rosy at sundown. Where a loving smile will greet me, always meet me at sundown. I seem to sigh.
Doris Day at sundown, which is the time of day when mother discovers to her sorrow the meaning of push-button warfare, which is briefly what happens when little Butch wants one program and Sandy wants another. This is Nightline. We hope you'll always want our program. We'll be right back with more of it in 60. Presidents to prime ministers, from princes to paupers, everyone likes a mystery. And tonight on Nightline, we have a man of mystery to match wits and witnesses with you, Nightline Detective Hans Conried. First, Detective Conried will summarize a case. There will be a musical minute for you to solve it in if you can, and then Hans will be back with a solution. Here he is now, Nightline Detective Hans Conried.
Walter, it was an evening last summer. I was driving to the J. Drexel Ryan estate in response to an urgent phone call from the lovely Mrs. Ryan, who told me over the phone that she was fearful for her husband's life. Drexel had been drinking even more than usual and was in one of his self-pitying moods. As he'd so frequently done in the past, he accused her of having a flirtation with one of their weekend guests, a certain Luis Garcia, and was threatening to take his own life. Well, Walter, a friend's a friend no matter the hour, and I agreed to drive down to East Hampton and calm Drexel down. As I entered the driveway leading to the Ryan Manor, silhouetted by an eerie moon, I was filled with a sense of foreboding. I'd expected everyone to be retired for the night, but as I came upon the swimming pool, there they all were, crowded about in pajamas and dressing gowns. Drexel Ryan was dead. drowned in the pool. Obviously, I'd arrived too late. The coroner had just removed the body from the pool's edge. But from the wet ring still outlining the dry area where Drexler had lain, I was able to determine accurately his final position. Marcia's voice reached me before I saw her. Hans, I was afraid, and I was right. After I called you, Drex got progressively worse. The more he drank, the more he threatened to take his life. At last he passed out, and Louis, Mr. Garcia, helped me get him upstairs to bed. Later, when all my guests had retired, Drex woke up, insisting, like a little boy, on going to the pool for a swim. Well, I couldn't stop him, but when he didn't come back after an hour, I slipped into my dressing gown and I went down to the pool. And there he was, lying on his back, half submerged, his feet bobbing against the near wall. I must have screamed. Hoping against hope there was still a chance to save him, I grabbed hold of his feet with all my strength, dragged him up onto the edge, and tried artificial respiration. A dark gentleman at her side, whom I took to be Luis Garcia, added the final words. And that's how we found her when we came running down to the pool after hearing her scream. It was awful. Marcia pressed my hand in hers. Then you won't mind testifying at the inquest, she said? I mean about my call to you that I was afraid Drex would kill himself? Why, I won't mind at all, I assured her. You are a darling, she smiled at me. And you, I smiled back, you are a murderess.
Ladies and gentlemen, in exactly 58 and one-half seconds, your Nightline mystery host, Hans Conried, will reveal the one glaring oversight in Marcia's story. Remember, the body lying on its back, half submerged, the scream, the final position on the pool's edge, outlined by the wet ring, the fact that the drowned man had been drinking, the fact that he was pulled from the water feet first, one glaring oversight. Can you detect what it was? Now, Mr. Conried, you said there was one glaring oversight in her story that branded it a tissue of lies and pointed the finger of guilt directly at Marcia Rhine.
Yes, I did, Walter. It said in the book that he shall not prosper who makes lies, and this was never more evidence than in Marcia's case. The truth was this. When the party guests had retired, Marcia and Louis took her unconscious husband down to the pool where they stretched him out on the edge with his head protruding into the water until he was dead. Then they left him sprawled out beside the pool after dumping a pailful of water over him. The one glaring oversight was failing to take into account the dry area underneath the body, which I found outlined by a wet ring. Had Marcia pulled her husband from the pool as she claimed, he would have been wet underneath as well as above. Drexel Rhine had not been immersed in the pool at all, except for his face. And that was the oversight, Walter. And that's our mystery for this evening. So this is Hans Conried saying, good night, dear mystery fans. And if we both walk cautiously, perhaps we'll meet again soon.
You've just heard Hans Conried, the Nightline detective, and I have a hunch you'll be hearing a lot more from him, too. Did you solve that one? I didn't. I thought it was a silent butler. Well, better luck next time. Right now, it's time for me to be silent, but only for a few moments, because Nightline will be right back in 60.
Recently, I read an article about the decline and fall of the cigar box. It seems they're slowly becoming extinct, and it's a shame.
They were so useful back in the what we call the good old days. A great safe deposit place for little boys' immies. Good for keeping tadpoles or small garter snakes, too. And didn't Sister get a shock when she opened your cigar box, thinking it was the one she kept her paper dolls in? Anyway, now cigar boxes are going, being replaced by little cardboard five-packs. There was one comfort, though, in the cigar box report. The fact that as many empty boxes as ever are still being used by storekeepers for making change. The good old days. But were they really so good? For another set of opinions on that question, let's join our sounding board in New Orleans.
Hello, Walter. This is Bruce Miller of WDSU in New Orleans. I am standing on the corner of Canal and Bourbon Streets in the Crescent City, and I have a group of people with me right now. Walter O'Keefe, who is listening on the open line in New York, would like to know how you feel about this. A few days ago, Arthur Treacher, the noted character actor, was on board talking about how good the good old days were. And what Walter would like to know is just how good were the good old days, or were they really better than today? May I have your name, please?
B.C. Castellone.
Where's your hometown, sir?
Atlanta, Georgia.
And what do you do?
I'm a merchandising specialist for the Army.
What about the good old days? What is your opinion on them as compared to today?
I just hope they don't ever return.
You hope they don't ever return?
That is correct.
What about today?
I'm very happy with things like they are today. I just hope prosperity continues like it is right now.
Well, there's certainly a solid vote for the present time. Thank you very much, sir. May I have your name, please?
This is B.C. Castellaw.
And what are you, a housewife?
Housewife.
I see. What about the good old days? Do you think they were the better time, or is it today even better?
Well, I'm afraid I don't know, because I don't think I go back quite that far.
In other words, today is the time, right?
When they say the good old times, that was my grandfather's time, I'm afraid.
Well, I see. Thank you very much, Miss Castello. May I have your name, sir?
Yes, my name is Colonel Kenderdine. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas.
And obviously you are in the service. Can you tell us which branch?
Yes, I'm in the Quartermaster Corps of the United States Army.
I see. Well, now you've heard our question, sir. What do you think about the good old times? Were they the good old days, or is today better?
Well, sir, I'm glad that the good old days are gone forever. I think all of the good days are before us here in America. I think the next 10 to 15 to 25 years will be our most golden years.
Well, thank you very much, sir. We appreciate those comments. May I have your name, ma'am?
Patricia Clare.
And what do you do?
I'm a secretary.
Where is your hometown?
I'm from New Orleans.
From New Orleans. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the good old days?
Well, I think I'm a little partial to the good old days.
You like the good old days?
Well, there's
a switch. Why?
Well, I think that we had a calm, cool, and collected world at that time. I think it's a little too hectic now.
In other words, you don't like the ulcerous times of today?
Definitely not.
Thank you very, very much. We have another gentleman here we'd like to talk to. What is your name, sir?
Don Rand.
And what do you do, sir?
I'm a writer.
Where is your hometown?
New Orleans.
From New Orleans as well. What is your opinion about the good old days as compared to today? Well,
I think it's a matter of perspective, actually. I believe as we grow older, we make a reference to some earlier period in our lives, perhaps a happier period, or one in which we were free of responsibility. And to us, that has the identity of the good old days. But today is wonderful, too.
Well, there's quite a cross-section, Walter. There's no question about it. You've heard the opinions of some New Orleanians, some tourists as well, and right from the heart of our city. And this is Bruce Miller of WDSU in New Orleans.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, New Orleans. Tomorrow night, another sounding board. Same question, different city, Reno, Nevada. This is Nightline, continuing in a moment, but first hear this.
This is Don Amici. What happens when a man falls in love? A lot of things. Crazy, romantic, mixed-up things. Sad, mad, as well as glad things. All of these and a lot more happen to Dan O'Connell. They happen fast. The biggest, most romantic episode in Dan's life took just 4 days out of a 3-week vacation in the south of France.
Don Amici stars as an American engineer who finds romance and mystery on a European holiday in The Day After Never. This week's drama on Don Amici's real life stories. The outstanding new dramatic series which stars Don Amici in a complete original drama each week. Don Amici's real life stories is heard immediately following My True Story, America's number one morning radio program, every weekday over most of these NBC stations. Here's Paul Weston with a woman who can't seem to make up her mind, or can she? What'd she say? Well, one thing's sure, the name of the song is She Didn't Say Yes.
You're about to tune in on the movie hit of the year. From the movie South Pacific, Rodgers and Hammerstein's immortal musical, RCA Victor brings you the original soundtrack recording in brilliant new orthophonic high fidelity. Hear it in the new RCA Victor long play album, in the 45 economy package, or on stereophonic tape. South Pacific, an original soundtrack recording by RCA Victor. Today, for the first time in 6 weeks, the top newsmen in Washington crowded into a huge auditorium in the old State Department building across the street from the White House in Washington. President Eisenhower strode before the blinding spotlights and microphones and opened a news conference which was destined to cover a wide variety of important matters. NBC News, of course, was there, and reporter Frank McGee has prepared a recorded digest of the president's most important remarks. Frank?
The questions of armament and disarmament, Walter, and the chances of a summit conference reconciling their conflicts absorbed much of the president's news conference today. While we're arming ourselves with nuclear weapons of frightening possibility, we're also trying to make them as humane as possible by reducing their radioactive fallout. And the president announced a unique plan in this regard.
In line with what I said to the press on July 3, 1957, the United States will demonstrate the progress our scientists are achieving in reducing radioactive fallout from nuclear explosions. To this end, for the first time at any test, we are planning to invite the United Nations to select a group of qualified scientific observers to witness at the Pacific Proving Ground this summer a large nuclear explosion in which radioactive fallout will be drastically reduced.
The question immediately arose whether the Russians would be included in the group invited by the United Nations.
Of course, I can't tell what they will accept, but we are hopeful that the United Nations will designate the Scientific Committee for Detection, I believe it is, of Radioactivity. That's about its name. And on that committee are USSR, Czechoslovakia, United States, UK, Canada, a few others.
And then, in connection with attempts to reach an agreement to disarm, a question whether nuclear test by an unfriendly country can really be detected, and whether we would agree to end nuclear weapons test without ending nuclear weapons production.
Certainly, I believe it would be unwise to take a perfectly rigid position in respect to any of these things where any agreement would seem to be a reliable one and would seem to be opening the door to wider and better negotiations with the Soviet Union. Now, I have not only had many conferences with Dr. Killian, but with others in the scientific world upon this feasibility of detecting tests. I think there's certainly a feel for uncertainty and some differing opinion, I think that by and large, for any sizable test of any kind, if it didn't go way down into the, or you might say, fractional kiloton, that the test ought, with proper proper inspectional facilities, seismic and electronic and so on, that they ought to be detectable.
And then, Walter, a tough question for the president or anyone else. How close are we to having a summit meeting?
Well, that's a very difficult situation thing. I mean, a guess to make, you might say. This is what I am trying to do. I'm trying to maintain a position that I think is conciliatory, that will reflect reasonableness and logic and truth as we see it. Now, we simply, as I see it, must not, by going to a summit meeting, appear to accept every contention that the Soviets are now making. In other words, we must not tacitly say, yes, we approve of everything that they are now saying as possible subjects for conversation is necessarily true or acceptable to us. We must be, as I say again, we must be careful to prepare these meetings properly.
And finally, have we changed our mind about holding a summit conference in this country because we're afraid Russia's Khrushchev would gain prestige from a Washington visit or possibly make a hit with Americans?
I have no change in the view I've already expressed, but I will tell you this. By no means do I fear the results on America of a visit by Mr. Khrushchev.
As for the recession, Walter, the president said a tax cut was a possibility, but Democrats and Republicans were agreed they'd not be stampeded into hasty action, that he thinks we're going through the worst of the recession right now, that better salesmanship and a few bargains would do wonders to stimulate buying and selling and promote economic recovery.
Thank you, Frank McGee, for Nightline's White House Digest. And that, my good friends, is that for tonight's Nightline. Tomorrow night, we are planning to return. We hope you are, too. We start a half hour earlier with the Stardust Edition, which will star George Gobel, Fibber McGee and Molly, and Bob and Ray. We'll move from there into old friends, new friends, assorted tried and true friends, people like Mort Saul for humor, Leo DeRocher squeezing the best news he can out of the Grapefruit League. Our sounding board tomorrow night will sum up its week's findings, and they will be in Reno, Nevada. And a gentleman editor from that blue book of the great, the near great, and the first rate called Who's Who in America. Who's Who on Nightline? Well, I'm Walter O'Keefe, and it's time for me to say goodnight for Nightline until tomorrow.
Hollywood's most glamorous event, the annual Academy Awards show. Hear it tonight over most of these same NBC stations.